Happy New Year. One of the neat things about the faithfulness of God is that it's often expressed through people. Like, I know there are many times that God's faithfulness comes to us independent of one another. But as I read through the Bible, it seems to me that, and I wouldn't want to attach a percentage to this, that so often the delivery system for God's faithfulness is ordinary people like you and I. And so Diane and I feel extremely blessed to experience the faithfulness of God through our Balmoral family. Every week, we experience it in big, medium, and little ways. And it's cool, and we're thankful for it. Well, on a day like today, I really want to pass off some warm thoughts to you. It's so cold out there. Today, our passage is going to be in the Old Testament from the book of Exodus. And I don't know about you, but when I think of Exodus, I think of Egypt. I think of sand, pyramids, warmth. So hopefully there will be some warmth that'll radiate from the passage into your life. I had a bit of an Egypt connection the other day. I was calling our travel agent. It seemed to me that the gal had a bit of an accent. And I always inquire, where are we today? And sure enough, it was a call center in, of all places, Cairo, Egypt. So that's my personal Egypt connection today with our passage. If you've checked the bulletin, you'll realize that we're starting a new series today called Old Testament Vignettes. What's a vignette? A vignette is a sketch. It's an episode. In the Old Testament, it's a story. And so we're going to focus over the next couple of weeks on a number of these Old Testament sketches. And if you want all that there is to know about this series, all you have to do is access it on our website. And so you can check in each week, and you'll know what's coming up on the following Sunday. Well, today we want to look at a story that's taken from Exodus chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2. And I'm calling it a deliverance story. A number of years ago, my brother was really excited about a new purchase that he'd made. He's a little older than me. He's a bachelor. Gets excited about these gadgets that he buys. He told us about a new TV that he was purchasing. I think it was a Sony, and it had some new technology in it. It had some new technology in it called PIP. Does anybody remember what PIP was? Is? Right, it's a picture in a picture. Probably only guys would get excited about this, but just imagine you could be sitting there on a Saturday afternoon watching a football game, and up there in the corner you could also be watching a baseball game. So embedded within the larger picture is a smaller picture. And there are two stories, two events that are unfolding simultaneously. I think that's often how the Bible was written, with this picture-in-a-picture technology. Except we might call it SIS. There's a story in a story. There's a larger event. So when you come to the beginning of Exodus, the book of, you realize that you're in store for this great story of how God redeemed his people, the Exodus, the exit from Egypt. But what we also discover is that embedded within these larger stories, we also have some little episodes, some stories, some events that take place down on the ground. These are stories that really put a face on the larger event. Remember a number of years ago, my wife's uncle came to me and he put a book in my hand. It was a thick book, and I thought, oh boy, what am I getting into here? It was a book about the Great Depression. Now, most of us, when we think about the Great Depression, we might think of, you know, the dirty 30s, or, you know, we think of the market crash, and we kind of think really big picture. But that's not what this book was about. This book was about the little stories, the little episodes, the little events that took place that unfolded in the lives of Canadians from coast to coast. And the person who had written this book was a newspaper reporter from Winnipeg, worked for the Winnipeg Free Press. That resonates with me because for many years I was a Winnipeg Free Press paper carrier. He wrote just short little chapters of what their experience of the Depression was like. These were wealthy people, not so wealthy people, men, women, single moms, people who lived in the city, people who lived in the country. And by the time I got to the end of this book, I had a whole new appreciation for what we mean when we just sort of use that large description, the Great Depression. And some people were amazingly resourceful. I mean, people survived. And they did it in some of the strangest ways. If you ever get a hold of that book, I'd encourage you to read it. I think often the Bible comes to us that way. We have these large events, and then embedded within them, we have smaller events, more personal stories. So the story of Exodus contains human drama stories, and we're going to look at one of those today. So if I were to put a title on the sections that we're looking at today, I would refer to it as a story, a deliverance story in a deliverance story. There's a big deliverance, but there's also a little deliverance that involves a baby. Let me read to you parts of Exodus chapter 1. Let's get the backstory of the Exodus in front of us. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family. And then he names them all. And that includes Joseph, who was already in Egypt. Verse 6. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. A couple of things here. Many of you know the story from Sunday school or camp or DVBS. First, there was a timely migration. Genesis talks about this, but the opening verses of Exodus also refer to it. And you will remember that because of a natural disaster that was unfolding in the ancient Near East, it was necessary for people to go elsewhere to find food. And that's exactly what happened in Genesis 47. The writer of Genesis tells us that the region was wasting away. And that strikes me as maybe the language of starvation. I've been hungry before, and I've maybe even used language of starvation. I could eat a horse, or I'm starving, but I've never really starved. But this was a time when the descendants of Abraham, the very people that God said he would preserve, the one through whom he would build a great nation, their lives were in jeopardy because they were starving. And so there was this timely migration from Canaan down to you-know-where, Egypt. And it was in Egypt that, thanks to their long-lost brother Joseph, that the seed of Abraham, the descendants of Jacob, were preserved. It's almost like God was allowing the nation to incubate. These 70 people needed a place where they could develop and where they could grow. And that's what we see happening in Egypt. So there was this timely migration. But then in verses 6 through 22, and we haven't read it all, but I think many of you know the passage, there was this miraculous multiplication. These 70 people started having babies and more babies, and their numbers just incredibly increased. As their numbers increased, they discovered that they began to lose favor of Pharaoh. Now, while Joseph was alive, they enjoyed great favor with Pharaoh. Pharaoh viewed the Israelites, the descendants of Jacob, as a source of blessing. And it was great having them around. But now as their numbers began to increase, they began to view them as a threat to their national security. Something similar to this happened in Canada a long time ago. For those of you who remember your Canadian history, the 17th century, there was an event that involved people we call the Acadians. I must have missed that class in high school history or junior high, because when we lived in Nova Scotia, we would often hear people talking about the Great Acadian Expulsion. The Acadians were French people, people of French ancestry, and they were living in parts of the Maritimes. There were lots of English people there as well, and the British were afraid that if Britain and France ever went to war, and the war spilled over into the New World, that all of these Acadians would side with their French ancestors and fight against the Brits. And so the English came up with this bright idea of literally expelling thousands and thousands of these Acadians to different parts of the world. There's a great museum in, I think it's Wolfville, Nova Scotia, or just outside of Wolfville, that tells the story of this expulsion. But of course, what was happening was these Acadians were no longer viewed as good citizens, and they had to be dealt with. They had to get rid of them. Well, that's kind of how Pharaoh was starting to treat these Israelites. There were too many of them, and in a case of war, who knows which side they would go on. And so they began to develop these repressive measures. They enslaved them all. They adopted the policy of genocide, where all male Israeli infants could be killed, should be killed. And he began to ask different people to help them to get rid of them. Now, the discerning reader, the reader who's been through Genesis, knows that there's a backstory going on here, that God is at work fulfilling his ancient promises to Abraham. He had said to Abraham on one occasion, Abraham, if you could count the particles of dust here on earth, that would give you some indication of how large this great nation is going to be that I will develop through Abraham. God was fulfilling his ancient promise to build a great nation from Abraham's descendants. But you know, as nice as it is to talk about the promises of God, and it is good, it's always encouraging to know that God is for us. It's encouraging to know that God is willing to commit himself to us. That's what promises are about. People share commitments with one another. But there's a bit of a dark side to this thing we call a promise. And that is that often promises contain a time clause. And time clauses often translate into waiting. And the Jews are living in Egypt, waiting for God to act, waiting for God to preserve them, waiting to get them out of Egypt and back into the promised land. And it's taking a long time, century after century after century. And far as they can tell, God ain't doing a thing. And it must have been discouraging. They must have been despondent. Yet within this backstory to the Exodus is another story. It's a sketch, it's a vignette of what's happening on the ground. And it has to do with Israel's future liberator, Moses. We know him by name. So in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, we now have the story in a story of how God delivered a deliverer. Usually we think of, you know, deliverers are really, you know, strong, sturdy, robust people. They do the delivering. Before Moses could do any delivering, he himself, as an infant, needed to be delivered himself. So let's read this section now in chapter 2. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slaves to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will repay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." We now go from kind of a bird's eye view of the story of the Exodus to a worm's eye view. We now go down to the ground. Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, there's an untimely birth. Of all the times to have a baby, of all the times to start building a family, this had to be the worst time. Because any male child that was born was automatically under a sentence of death. So not a great time. I would love to have been there the day that Moses' dad came home from work and Moses' mom starts explaining to him that we're going to have a baby. May not have been all that joyous a day. Children were under the sentence of death. I don't know what you would have done. Moses' mom did what she could. She did what she could best do. She tried to hide the baby for 3 months. Not sure why 3 months, but after 3 months, she realized that this ain't working. We've got to come up with another plan. When you're reading through Genesis and Exodus, and you know where the story is going, it looks like the plan of God is hanging by a slender thread. Like you'd think God would develop a plan that had more strength. I mean, this is depending upon a guy baby, a male baby, and there's a price on all male babies' heads. That doesn't sound like a good plan, does it? God often does this. He develops these plans that hang by a slender thread. Like when he created the world and he peopled the planet with folks like you and I. He put the stewardship of earth in our hands. And you know how well we did that. Later on, he decides to build a nation through Abraham, a man who's getting on in years. He's in his 70s. He's waiting. 80s, waiting. Now he's in his 90s, his late 90s. And God is still as enthusiastic about his plan as he was, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But Abraham and Sarah aren't so thrilled about it. They're not seeing possibility here. This just looks more like an impossibility. But so often the plan of God hangs on a slender thread. It looks like not going to happen. You felt like that. I felt like that. I'm not going to get into seminary. And then when I get there, I'm not going to get through seminary. This is way more expensive than I ever thought it would be. We're toast. And on throughout the course of our lives, we feel like not going to happen. And time again, God steps into the story, rearranges the furniture, demonstrates his faithfulness, and what looked like an impossibility becomes a possibility. I'm sure if we put an open mic right there, we could easily spend the next couple of hours just listening to stories of how, and the plan seemed to hang by a slender thread, and then guess what happened? That's the kind of story that we have here. So in verses 1 and 2, there's an untimely birth. Now in verses 3 and 4, we see what I think of as a desperate move. Desperate isn't something we like to admit to very often, but I think we experience it more often than we admit to it. We just feel helpless. We feel powerless. This is a desperate moment. And that's how Moses' mom must have felt. Having done the best that she could, after 90 days of trying to keep this son silent and, you know, out of the range of the hearing of the authorities, she decides to build a seaworthy basket. What is she thinking here? And then she takes this basket and she places it, I want to say, in a safe place. But really, how safe is a baby in a basket in the reeds on the Nile? Maybe at best we could say it was a safer place, because apparently the currents aren't quite as strong. So, you know, it's not going to be drawn out into the open water where it would be discovered sooner. And I also understand that crocodiles aren't as prone to hang out in the bulrushes as they are on the sandy beaches. So maybe it was safer, but certainly not safe. And then she posted someone to see what would happen. Like, it's tempting to read all sorts of things into the story at this point, but I don't know about you, I'm not seeing a great plan here. We'll see what'll happen. Does that sound like a great plan to you? You know? It kind of makes me nervous. We're going to see what will happen. It strikes me that there are times when we must release what is precious to us. I can't imagine anything being more precious to a parent than a child. What's most precious to you? Maybe it's your spouse. I don't know if it's your career. I don't know if it's your wealth. I don't know what it is that is most precious to you. But there are times when we must release what is precious in the hope that God will see, that he will care, and that he will help out. But it often feels like a real long shot. And there this lady is, doing a desperate thing, putting the baby there in the Nile to see what would happen. We'll come back to that a little later. Verses 5 to 10, there's what I would call an astonishing outcome. Notice what happens. I mean, she was waiting to see what would happen. So what happened? Well, this is what happened. First of all, the baby was discovered by a royal. At this point, we don't know if that's good, bad, or ugly. I mean, I can imagine her blowing the whistle around her neck, and the guards come running and, you know, deal with the situation. A baby was discovered by a royal. This daughter of Pharaoh sees the child and feels much the same way most of us would feel in the presence of a newborn. Our heart would go out to it. There would be compassion. There would be, you know, all kinds of good, maternal, loving feelings. And it turns out that she not only cares for the baby, but she wants to provide care for the baby. And so through a series of circumstances, the mother of the child becomes the paid wet nurse for the child. This may be the first paid maternity leave in history, but she is getting kind of what she wants. She wants her baby to live, and I'm sure she wants to be near her child, wants to care for her child, and it's happening. So they were waiting to see what was happening. This is one of the things that was happening. And then later on, and the story is so compressed, there's all sorts of questions that we have, and the writer says, don't worry about it. That stuff doesn't matter. A number of years later, the child, Moses, is adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. Now just think about that for a moment. We've heard the story way too many times to appreciate it. Moses is now part of the royal family, and we know what his career will consist of. He's the one that is going to debunk the royal family of Egypt. He is going to be the one through whom God will work against them. He will be the enemy of the state, and the state is caring for him. They're giving him a great upbringing. They're paying all of his tuition, all of his room and board. It's a good deal. And then last of all, we read that he's named, rather well named, you know. He's called Moshe. Bit of a play on words there, because Moshe sounds like the Hebrew word for to draw out. And it not only nicely describes Moses' deliverance, he was drawn out of the Nile, but it also describes nicely, it foreshadows nicely what God will use him to accomplish in the lives of Israel. He will be the one through whom God draws them out. So he is well named. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? These names that seem to have such great destiny to them. For most of us, when we got our name, it was purely by gosh and by golly, but I like the way this works out. So God was preserving the one who would one day liberate the Israelites. He was doing something. I imagine that if I would have been one of those Israelites, century after century after century, 400 years, I would have been convinced that God had, you know, closed the book on our history, had left our quadrant of the universe, and had gone somewhere to do who knows what, but we were no longer part of the picture. We had been forgotten. And the writer of the Exodus keeps reminding his readers, God is doing something. When you think he's doing something, he's doing something. When you don't think he's doing something, he's doing something. He is, after all, the God who acts, and he's acting. They didn't all appreciate it, of course, at the time. So what does this story have to say to us? This is the tricky part. It does have something to say to us. And to some extent, I think when we get to this part of the sermon or this part of Bible study, we naturally slide the lens of our own experience, our present experience, over it. So perhaps that colors some of the ideas that I want to share with you now. One of the things that the story does is it reveals God to us as one who brings us into places, because I believe the Israelites were in the place where they were on purpose. It reveals God as one who brings us into places that are sometimes, I hate to say this, especially to those of you who have parents with young children, God brings us into places that are dangerous. We don't wish danger on anyone. We don't wish danger on ourselves. But those of us who have lived long enough appreciate the danger is part of the dance. I mean, how many of us, when our kids were little, we had these neat little child dedication moments in a service where we said, God, we know you've given this baby to us, and we're going to do our doggone best to raise him in the fear and admonition of the Lord. But just between you and us, God, we know that the child is yours. Yours to take, yours to dispatch, yours to use. And we don't know what that entails, do we? We're kind of like Mrs. Moses who, you know, posts somebody there to see what will happen. So for the rest of our lives or the rest of our children's lives, we kind of watch to see what will happen. Sometimes God takes us and our loved ones, that which is most precious to us, into dangerous places. When I was in Fall River, I met up with a guy, Don was his name, who had gone to high school with me at Cairnport. And we had never imagined that we would meet again. And so there we are now, both going to the same church, living in the same community, and we have children who are about the same age. And one of their children was Christiane, and she would always come to our home and play with my Christy. And their favorite game was Mario Brothers something or other. It was a video game. I got so tired of hearing that tune playing over and over again. And they're just little tykes. Well, I eventually left Fall River and I moved to Edmonton. And while I was in Edmonton, my son Matt was going to Southview Christian Fellowship. And unbeknownst to me, Christiane had moved to Edmonton to study nursing. She wanted to be a missionary nurse. And she came into our lives kind of through the back door. And I eventually pastored Southview. And so now this little girl who had grown up to be, oh, a beautiful, capable, wise, talented Christian woman was off to the mission field, and we were supporting her. Well, she has landed in, of all places, South Sudan. That's where she is today. Boy, if I was her parents, I'd probably be having conversations with the Lord. Keep her safe. Bring her home. I don't know. Danger. We realize what it is we commended our children to, what our parents commended us to. Sometimes there will be moments of danger. Moses and perhaps his mother were certainly in harm's way. Our friend Christiane is in harm's way. Some of you have loved ones right now who are in harm's way. It's tough. It's part of the dance. God also brings us into places where we experience a profound desperation. We find ourselves in places where the way ahead just isn't obvious. It's just not obvious. There's an element of by gosh and by golly. I mean, sometimes we joke and we say, come on over tonight. We don't know what we're going to do. We're going to make it up. And we have a good laugh over it. But truth be told, how much of life is like that? We don't know what's happening in 2014, but we'll kind of make it up as we go along. Or God will make it up as we go along, and we'll try to adapt and adjust to it. I think this story reveals God as one who brings us into places that are both dangerous and desperate. And we don't like to talk about those things. We don't want to wish those things on each other. But it is part of the journey. And I know for some of us here at the chapel, these days it's been especially part of the journey. It's tough. Secondly, it reveals how faith sometimes involves releasing that which is most precious into the unseen and invisible hands of God. And the best we can do is just, let's see what happens. Sometimes the most caring thing that we can do is release that which is most precious to us. The most caring thing that we can do, the best thing that we can do. It's like a gesture. My children are old enough that I do this on a fairly regular basis. I have three adult children. Some of you know them. One of them has nicely found his way into the things of God. And I love all my children. And I also love watching that child as he lives out his faith under God. It's great to see. I'm instructed by it. I'm challenged by it. And I enjoy it. But I have two children who, although at one time had walked with God, today does not appear to me that they are continuing in that journey. So if you watched me, if you could kind of, you know, maybe slip one of those little spy cameras into my home, you would see me sometimes walking around the home and just doing this in my prayers. Lord, my children, that which is most precious to me, I release them to you again. I know I just did it yesterday, but I think I need to do it again today. It's the best that I can do. It's the best that I know how to do. And I think Mrs. Moses was doing that when she built the boat and launched little Moses onto the Nile. It was an admission of her weakness and her helplessness. Now, we've known this all along, even though we're slow to admit it as adults. As children, we used to sing, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong, they're weak, but he is strong. I don't know about you, but I'm still weak. I'm still powerless. I don't have nearly the influence that I would like to have in that which is most precious to me. And so we just kind of go through this gesture, this Christian gesture of releasing and letting go into the unseen hands of the invisible God to see what will happen. And that's okay. I have some Christians, friends in other traditions, who seem to have an incredible amount of clarity about what the future will hold. Half the time, I don't believe them. I think they're just guessing. I don't think they know. I don't think they're any smarter than the rest of us. I don't think they have any more of a corner into the plan and the purpose of God. They've just convinced themselves that they do. More often than not, most of us are like Mrs. Moses. We're waiting to see what will happen. And then finally, in this story, we see revealed an approach to living that trusts God for the outcome. Not my wits, not my great plan, but God. It's the kind of faith that says, come what may, I will trust in the Lord. I can still remember as a young student in college at Providence, we had a new instructor. He was a no-name. This guy was untested. His name was Dan Block. Today, if you know anything about religious studies, Dan Block is an Old Testament specialist of great renown, and he teaches at Wheaton College. Well, this is one of his first classes, and he's teaching us about Job. And I don't know why, but for some reason I tuned into the lesson that day, and he said something that I've remembered ever since. This is a long time ago. He was talking about the message of Job. And he said the message of Job is that it is the nature of true faith to trust in God, come what may. No conditions, no deals. It's just, God, I will trust you, and I will trust you for the outcome no matter what. I think that's where Mrs. Moses was, Moses' mom. And it's a way of living. And at first, we really stutter with this, and we stumble as young Christians. And then over the years, you know, we have strengthened our, I don't know, we've just through practice, I guess, through practice, we've learned to do it a little bit better. And we just really believe that we don't have all the answers, and we really don't know what the outcome is. But there is a God, and he is good, and he is great, and we can trust him. And so we just sort of, you know, abandoned all sense of clarity, and we just lean into this invisible God as best we can. And he shows himself faithful in ways that sometimes we do and sometimes don't fully understand. That's what Job learned. And that's the kind of life that I want to lead. And I'd like to lead others in living that kind of life. Some of you lead me into learning to live that kind of a life. And I thank you for it. But that's the direction that we all need to be going in. No one is saying that this is easy. But we are saying that this is the life that God calls us to. It's a life that loses itself. It's a life that loses itself not in what is most precious to us, as great as the temptation of that may be. It's a life that loses itself in God and in his plan and his purpose and his goodness. We know that ultimately the buck stops with God, and that's a good thing because he's good and he's wise. God, we've spent a few moments today thinking about the big picture of the Exodus, where you so marvelously demonstrated your power and your promise-keeping character. And we've also looked at a smaller story and the big story. We thank you for the woman who was the mother of Moses. And we can't imagine what her journey was like. But we thank you for the way that she set an example for us to follow, a lady who trusted in you. And we want to join her in being those kinds of people. Thank you for being trustworthy, for being faithful. We pray that you would wean us off self-reliance, that you would wean us off the wisdom of the world and our culture, and that increasingly we would become countercultural and counterintuitive. You are good. We love you.